The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So here in the United States, we're coming up to an election next week, next Tuesday, a week from today, we'll have our election. And it's been quite a divisive time in this country. And I think it feels like I've seen, you know, that the coronavirus has also revealed divisions around the world. It's, you know, it's been a challenging time for all of us. The stress of our time has, you know, sometimes I feel like when we're under stress in this way, we kind of revert to our habits and patterns and conditioning. And I see this happening all over the place, how we all kind of go to our corners and want to hold our cards and our toys and say, you know, this is the way I want it to be. And so my sense is that it's quite likely, at least here in the States with the election coming up, that no matter how the election comes out, that there may continue to be conflict and divisions, and maybe even more exacerbated in a way. So I've been over the last few weeks looking at what do the teachings of the Buddha have to say about navigating conflict, navigating dispute, division? How does it come to be, and how can we work with it in our practice? There's quite a bit actually in there. The Buddha created a community, and communities have conflict. So he did speak, he taught about how to work with it. A lot of his teachings did have to do with his monastic community, working with particularly, it seems as though the biggest forms of dispute happened around the rules and the guidance in the community, you know, what was proper to do when. And one huge dispute that is recorded in the suttas, the quarrel at Kosambi. The backstory of that it arose over whether one monk left a little bit of water in the container in the latrine. So that, you know, that huge dispute that got recorded in the suttas arose out of something so small, you know, something seemingly so trivial. And so this is this, so the community of monastics at the time of the Buddha was not immune from conflict. Because we're human, you know, this is a human thing, that we have certain ideas about how things should be. We've been conditioned in a certain way. We grow up with certain views and opinions, and others grow up with different views, and then perhaps the views come into conflict with each other. Actually, the Buddha pointed to holding to views, holding to fixed views, as being one of the main sources of dispute, the main sources of conflict. There's a famous teaching story, and I think most of you have probably heard it, but I'll just review it, remind you of this teaching story. It's the story of the blind people and the elephant. And the Buddha is talking with his followers about quarrels and disputes in the Dharma, and saying how people will say, you know, the Dharma's like this, the Dharma's not like that, you're wrong, I'm right, only this is true. And so this kind of is what was coming up in some of the communities. And so he talked about he used a teaching story to point to how these holding to views is not helpful, and also potentially not seeing the bigger picture. I feel like that's a big piece of the teaching with the blind people and the elephant. And so the story goes that a king asked his elephant trainer to bring an elephant and to gather the blind people in the kingdom and to show the blind people the elephant by having them each touch various parts of the elephant. So to some, he showed the side of the elephant. And the story goes, with each thing, he told the person, this is an elephant, touch the side. This is an elephant, touch the tail. This is an elephant, touch the ear. This is an elephant, touch the foot. This is an elephant. And then when they were all asked to describe what an elephant is, they all used a kind of an analogy. Well, an elephant is like a broom for those who touched the tail. The elephant is like the side of a storeroom for those who touched the wall. An elephant is like a post for those who touched the foot. And hearing each other's descriptions of what an elephant is, they began quarreling and saying, no, you're wrong. I'm right. This is how an elephant is. That's not how an elephant is. So this story points to a couple of things, I think. One is that we do tend to form our views, well, not only based on what we're told, and this piece has there's two important pieces here. You know, they are shown a particular part of the elephant, but then they're also told this is an elephant. You know, they're kind of set up in a way. You know, this is an elephant. This foot, this tail, you know, this is an elephant. So they're given some information and then they have a direct experience. So those two pieces came together. They're not just told, this is what an elephant is like. Although we do that too. You know, we do gather information from our parents, from our schools, from our learning, and, you know, how we've learned, we tend to take up those beliefs. Even without direct experience, we can take up those beliefs. But in the case where we have direct experience, and this is something the Buddha points to in several places, that when we have a direct experience, the views that are created out of that direct experience can be very, very sticky. So they're told, this is an elephant, and they've got an experience of the elephant that they contacted. And so, you know, they trust their senses. They trust their senses. This is what I experienced an elephant is like. How can you say it's like a storeroom? It's obviously like a foot. It's like a post. How can you say that? So you know, it's important to recognize that each person actually, and I think this is a piece of the story, although it's not elaborated in the story, but to me it's an important piece. Everybody had their own view about what an elephant was, and that view, that holding to that view, and this I think we can see this. To me, this story really resonates for what's happening in our country right now. You know, we when we hold to views, our perspective becomes limited. We want to convince others that we're right. We are not interested in hearing their perspective, and we can criticize others for their perspective. And this is what happened in the story. I'm right, you're wrong. And, you know, trying to convince each other that their perspective was right. The elephant is like this, not like that. So, but we know from the outside of this story, you know, we know from the perspective of knowing what an elephant is, that each person had a piece of the perspective. Each person had a part of the whole. And if instead of holding to their view, they had said something like, or got curious, huh, that's really odd. My experience was that an elephant was like a post. How can it be that you said it's like a storeroom? That's so odd. What's going on? If that had been the exploration, perhaps they could have put the pieces together and gotten a picture of the elephant by, kind of comparing notes. So there's a website that I've really gotten kind of interested in recently in this kind of divisive area of politics that we're having in the US. It's called All Sides. And it kind of gives news stories from different perspectives. And they say right up front, they said that we don't think it's possible to have unbiased news. And so what we'll show you is what the bias is of each of these stories. So you can get the same story from different perspectives. And maybe you can kind of begin to see what the, what's actually going on, seeing it from multiple perspectives. And this, one of the things I particularly appreciate about this website is that it's got a dictionary of terms that point to, how do different people see this term? What is the relationship that people from different perspectives have to this word? I think this is a really beautiful thing to reflect on, that even a single word can have different ideas and different perspectives around it. And in this dictionary, there was an entry for dialogue, which I really appreciated their perspective on what dialogue is. And I'm going to read you part of their definition of dialogue. They said, in comparison to debate, which has a primary aspiration towards winning rational arguments to achieve consensus or majority vote, and in comparison to deliberation, which has primary aspirations towards solving problems through consensus and examining all perspectives, and conflict resolution, with primary aspirations towards the cessation of disagreement and achieving reconciliation, dialogue has a unique aim. Rather than trying to convince or proselytize or resolve a conflict, the primary goal of dialogue is to understand more deeply other perspectives. Rather than being opponents who seek to expose the weakness in each other's arguments, dialogue participants engage in a conversation that starts with the assumption, as Thomas Schwant describes it, that the other has something to say to us and to contribute to our understanding. The initial task of dialogue is to grasp the other position in the strongest possible light. So this, I think, is a good place to start from in conversations, perhaps in opening doorway to communication, rather than trying to convince somebody of our perspective, try to understand their perspective. That has the benefit of perhaps them feeling heard, but also potentially of us broadening our perspective, seeing a different part of the elephant, maybe. And yet another piece of what I want to talk about today. There was a number of threads, a number of different explorations around this topic of conflict and dispute. And one of the things that was a little new to me, or a little bit, I wasn't quite as cognizant of this part of the Buddhist teaching. So one of the things that we tend to do in conflict is that, we often feel like we're right, the other person's wrong. And maybe in certain ways we have ethical or you know, some kind of ethical concerns around the other's perspective. You know, so there can be some sense of, you know, wanting to kind of shore up our perspective based on ethics or something like that. And one of the things that I found interesting in exploring these teachings was, you know, so this notion of wanting to point out somebody else's mistakes or failings, wanting to criticize, wanting to expose lies or deceit, you know, so this comes up a lot in conflict, I think. It not only is just about a particular view, but it's also comes into, you know, ethics can come into play. And so the texts don't actually say that we should never blame somebody or point out their failings. They do encourage us to investigate before doing so. So this, the teaching is on, it's, it uses a kind of a two sides. It says, you know, praising and blaming, you know, one should know what is praiseworthy and speak praise where praise is due, and one should know what is blameworthy and point out that, you know, what is dispraise. I'm going to read this text to you. Let's see. First of all, he points to having investigated and scrutinized, one speaks dispraise of one who deserves dispraise. Having investigated and scrutinized, one speaks praise of one who deserves praise. Having investigated and scrutinized, one is suspicious about a matter that merits suspicion. Having investigated and scrutinized, one believes a matter that merits belief. So this is encouraging us to investigate whether something is praiseworthy or blameworthy. And, you know, there's guidance in this in terms of, you know, ethics, the ethical guidelines, and in terms of the Dharma teachings also, this is a big area where this is primarily explored. What's praiseworthy and blameworthy is spoken to in terms of teaching the Dharma or talking about the Dharma. But I think it can also apply. We can also be curious about this in our everyday lives. What is praiseworthy? What is blameworthy? And the encouragement here is to investigate. So not just to assume a particular position. And just, I'll point back to what the All Sides website said about dialogue. You know, to try to understand the other person's position before praising or blaming. And there's another teaching that really points to that. You know, when there is a conflict between two people, the text says something like, well, you shouldn't just jump right into blaming somebody. You shouldn't just jump right into saying somebody's wrong. You should reflect first. And in that teaching, it says reflect on yourself and on the other. Reflect on where you're coming from. Are you coming from because you didn't like something? Because, you know, you just were irritated about something? What was your state of mind when this was happening? And also to investigate what's happening for the other person. So, you know, that kind of the dialogue is, I think, important in looking at what's praiseworthy and what's blameworthy. And then there's the question of how we might speak praise or dispraise. The translation of blame is sometimes dispraise, sometimes blame. There's another text that I found very, I put exclamation points in the book next to this column where this piece is described, because it talks about how do you neither extol nor disparage. And so we might think of, so extolling and disparaging are different terms than praise and blame. Extolling and disparaging, the teaching around extolling and disparaging is pointing to saying whether someone is good or bad, basically. And in the suttas, it points to specific things. And it's actually, I'll read this to you too. Because it's very clear. So the first thing in this text, and this text is called the Exposition of Non-Conflict. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya, and it's Sutta 139. And it starts by putting out some Dharma teachings. By you know, saying this is the way of the Dharma and this is not the way of the Dharma. So it lays out something that is skillful in terms of freedom. And so he says, one should not pursue sensual pleasure. The pursuit of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sense desire is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Disengagement from the pursuit of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sense desire is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and is the right way. And so he states something about his teaching and the Dharma here. I'm not going to get into the complexity of that teaching itself right now. It's a challenging one for us, I think, this particular teaching. But what I want to point to is a little bit later in the sutta, he says, how does there come to be extolling and disparaging? So he's laid out a teaching. One should not pursue the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sense desire is a state beset by suffering. So he says that. And then he says, how does there come to be extolling and disparaging? When one says, all those engaged in the pursuit of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sense desire are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way, one disparages some. When one says, those engaged in the pursuit, so where's the other part? Those not engaged, those disengaged from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasures link with sense desire are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered on the right way, one extolled some. And he says, we shouldn't extol and disparage. What does he suggest as an alternative? Here he says, how does there come to be neither extolling nor disparaging? And in this case, he says, but teaching only the Dharma. How does there come to be neither extolling nor disparaging, but teaching only the Dharma? Rather than saying, all those that engaged in the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasures linked to sense desire have entered upon the wrong way, one says instead, the pursuit of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sense desire is a state beset by suffering. And it is the wrong way. This is teaching the Dhamma. This is not disparaging. So the summary or the point of this, or the point here, is that the neither extolling nor disparaging is pointing to the state and the conditioning of the state, perhaps, rather than the person experiencing the state. the extolling and disparaging is talking about the person experiencing the state. All those who are doing this are going the wrong way, as opposed to the state of pursuing this is suffering. It's the wrong way. And so it's a different way of speaking. It's pointing to not blaming a person, but pointing to what's helpful and not helpful, what's skillful and not skillful. And so this is a challenge for us, I think. How might we speak in protest, not using disparaging and extolling, but rather speaking to that, you know, the conditions underlying this are heading us in the wrong way. And in everyday life, you know, it might be heading us, it is, you know, we could potentially add it, this is my understanding, this is my view that it's heading us in the wrong way. That's another way that the Buddha points to speaking truth. That rather than saying, this is the wrong way, you know, if we're not clear on that, or if we're not, you know, we understand that we're holding a view. It is my view that this is not helpful. It is my view that this creates damage. That would be speaking the truth. And so this too, I think, helps to create dialogue rather than, you know, kind of having people kind of, you know, when you come out and say, this is the way it is, even just slightly shifting it to, this is my understanding of the way it is, has a different effect on the listener. And so I think there's things for us to reflect on and consider in terms of how we navigate conflict. So those are the thoughts I wanted to share this morning. And, you know, we've got about 15 minutes here. So I want to hear from you what's up, and how does this land, or what does it evoke for you? Yeah, Jan.
I just had one quick comment. Those instructions remind me of Good Parenting 101, right? Because you teach the child, this is the consequences of that behavior, rather than you did a bad thing.
Yes.
Like educating them all along.
Exactly.
More effective than shaming them.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, or the kind of thing that I've often heard, rather than good, you know, good boy or bad, you know, good girl or bad boy or bad girl, it's good job, or here's why that wasn't so helpful. Yeah. Yeah, Bruce.
Wouldn't it be pretty to think so?
What do you mean? Wouldn't it be?
I think things are a little worse than that. I think we're way beyond the elephant, Andrea. We're like, is there an elephant in the room or not? I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm a little bit pessimistic about dialogue these days, because for there to be dialogue, you have to agree that red is red and green is green, I think. And I feel like there's not a basis for that kind of agreement right now. But so that's my. But I want to. Can I shift to something else?
I just want to say, you know, so that's a pretty hopeless perspective where you are in some ways. If you think there's no possibility for any kind of dialogue. I mean, I think what has to happen is you need to step back. So if you can't agree that red is red and green is green, you need to have a bigger container and say, okay, let's step back to something else. You know, let's see if there's anything we can agree on. Let's find some things to that we can agree on, and start from there to try to build a conversation. So I have heard about, you know, people being, you know, completely radically different views. If you put them in a room with some support and some context. And sometimes actually, you know, I loved that Heineken commercial of a few years ago. I don't know if any of you saw that Heineken commercial where they had two people with completely radically different views come together. And I think it was 2008 or 9 or something like that. It was quite a long time ago. And they were asked to do something together. You know, they had to spend a couple hours together building something together. And then they were shown videos of what their beliefs each were and asked, do you want to stay and have a conversation with this person or do you want to leave? And everybody chose, or were the ones they showed, I guess there probably could have been some that didn't, but you know, many of them chose to stay and have a conversation. So, you know, it doesn't even have to be that the thing that builds the bridges is an agreement of, you know, terms or something. It can be, we can, you know, we're both human beings. We can both accomplish something together, creating some kind of solidarity at some level. So I think I have not given up hope on humanity yet. I think it's pretty bad. I think it's pretty bad right now, but I think there are ways to navigate that.
Okay, Andrea, thank you for your optimism. I needed a booster shot.
And so the other thing you wanted to shift to.
That's okay. I'll come back to it later if we have time.
Okay. And if some others of you are feeling hopeless, you know, I don't know, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the coming months. You know, don't deny or repress that hopeless feeling, but also don't just sink into it. There's a middle way of understanding it is, this is condition two. This hopeless feeling is condition two. Yeah, Kate.
Well, two things. One thing I just became aware of, I'm reading a book that is it's a novel and it takes place in Kentucky in the 30s. And in it, there are these women that are kind of trying to live differently from, you know, just little ways from the way the convention is. And there's a Black woman, and I know where this is going. There are drunken men around, and I know there's going to be some horrible things that happen. And I just felt myself going, oh, I can't read this right now, because that's the fear that I kind of have, is of people doing bad things to people. But then I also said, hey, there were bad people in the 1930s. Why do you think it would be any, you know, and I'm using the word bad, obviously, unskillfully, but that idea. So that was just one thing that I realized. And then I was listening to Gil did this lovely meditation this morning about how to be with someone, use presence of just being with someone to allow their wisdom to come forth the way we allow our wisdom to come forth by being present with ourselves. And I was like, oh man, I got to listen to that one again because it was really deep. And then the other thing is I've been doing phone banking to Wisconsin, and I, you know, you hardly ever get anybody, but the other day I got somebody, which is like, I should have had red flags because it's the person who goes, well, I don't know, I haven't quite made up my mind yet. And then you get into this conversation. And one of the things I realized, and it speaks to what you were talking about, is having time to really talk with somebody and take like one issue. Like this guy had some real valid things about how the ACA, he had to pay all these fines, you know, so there's one issue, but you have to get to all the facts underpinning that and talk through all those. And you don't have time half the time with a person whose views are opposite yours in whatever situation you end up with.
Exactly. And so that I think that's a big point, is that it does take time. And, you know, but finding ways to create those kinds of dialogues, you know, I think that is probably something that could be useful for us. It's mm-hmm. Yeah, to find ways to create that kind of dialogue. And I think there are groups that are engaged in that. There's a couple that I've heard of recently. One is called the Human Library. Where you can talk to a person, and the Human Library, I think if you go on and find Human Library, I'm not sure, it used to be in-person conversations, now they're doing it all on Zoom or on video. And you know a little bit about the bio of the person. You know, this person is a transgendered person or whatever. And so there's a variety of people. And then you quote, check out the person like you would check out a book and have a conversation with them. And so these are people who've been trained in dialogue, and you're given the opportunity to spend some time with them. Another one is, I think it's called Kitchen Table Conversations, which bring together people in a small group with a facilitator to have conversations mm-hmm. around difficult issues. And it may be particularly topic related. So there are some people, and I think the All Sides website is also trying to create opportunities for dialogue. So there are some groups out there that are trying to do this. And so, you know, if you're interested in exploring this and working with it and practicing with it, that's a great way to go.
Okay. Thank you. You're leaving us all alone to navigate this next month.
It's true. I did want to remind you all, I am taking the month of November as a self-retreat. And maybe it seems like I'm like checking out, you know, opportunistically away from the election, but this was the month I was supposed to be at IMS. And so, it's basically the only opportunity I'm having this year to do a self-retreat. And it's kind of a gift that I am having it because of the pandemic. And so, yeah, I will be away for the month of November. I'll put that on the website though, so you'll remember that. I'll be back the first week of December. Yeah. But I'm, you know, Gil is going to be there most mornings, I think. I mean, I'm not really leaving you alone because there's so much Dharma out there, I know. Yeah.
And just for people to know, Mark Nunberg does a weekly thing at the same time. If anyone knows him and is interested, they could pick that up for the month.
Oh, great. Great. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, I think that's Common Ground.
Yes, Common Ground Meditation Center.
Yeah.
And I think it's from 10 to 11. So it's a little short. And it's just a sit and questions. It's not a Dharma talk, but it's, you know, it's nice.
Okay, great. Thank you for letting us know that. Yeah, great. Other comments or reflections on this topic of conflict? Despair. Yeah, Olga.
I find that I get some alleviation of this like anxiety over what will happen, how will this play out of anything, but certainly of the moment politically that we're negotiating and trying to find our way through, by just not eternalizing it, you know, by understanding that it's like this right now. And, you know, I think back in my own personal history and we happen to be in the, you know, in a very political moment, but thinking through the politics that I have lived through and even the politics that have arisen with people forever, as long as there's been a civilization, and people have dealt with tyrants and kind leaders. And I mean, there's been the whole spectrum, and this is,
there's nothing new under the sun.
Right. And not to see the current moment as static, you know, it seems so static. It seems like, well, this is just being set up to be like this. And watching that expectation sort of take root in my mind as almost a belief, or, you know, or standing on the train tracks and watching the train barreling toward you, you know, and understanding that those are conditioned thoughts that I'm having, and that this is, I just tell myself, this is not a static condition. This is subject to a Nietzsche the way everything is, and all the people that I may disagree with, even the people who agree with me, you know, they're not static either. So that helps me,
yeah,
to some extent, to know that this is just an ongoing unfolding, and it's very difficult to predict the trajectory.
It is, and it's important to recognize that beliefs shape the future.
Yeah. Mine certainly do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. So to understand that they are beliefs and that they have that shaping quality does have an effect, I think, too, on that, you know, to recognize, and to try
to stay in right view, you know, that's like, I have to continually remind myself, well, where's the wisdom here? What's the right view of this? And I'm, you know, it's not always like, oh, it'll all be okay.
No, we don't know that either.
Not okay.
We do not know that for sure.
I have a friend who's always saying, oh, it'll all work out. And I said, yeah, but how? out to what?
we don't know that it's going to work out. We don't know that everything's going to be okay. And yet one of the things that I feel, the practice can help us to meet whatever happens. You know,
yes.
That I have a lot of confidence in, you know, that, and the best way that I have to meet some future distress is to be present for what is this now, not to fantasize about future distress.
Exactly.
But to meet what this is. It's like that, this is the training for me for whatever unfolds.
Yes. So, the mind wants to jump to after the election. Like, what's that going to be? Right. But I also find it a little relieving to just, okay, today,
right, this is hour, what's here, this is what's here now.
Exactly.
And so,
and the preparation from the practice perspective, the preparation isn't about, oh, this is what's here now. It's great. Oh, I'm going to space out, you know, but no, this is what's here now. Let's be present with it, you know?
Yes. And develop some courage for what is yet to come.
Yes.
I mean, I find courage to be very front and center for me right now. Humans have had to have courage